Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shops, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. On Friday, the US carried out a targeted drone strike in Iraq, which killed General Qasem Soleimani, the leader of Iran's notorious Quds Force. The strike was in response to an earlier attack on the US embassy in Baghdad. Sophie Ridge spoke to the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab about the ongoing incident.
Many people this morning will be very concerned about the possibility of a full-blown conflict, even a war between the US and Iran. Was Donald Trump right to order the killing of Soleimani?
Well, first of all, I share those concerns. We're looking to de-escalate and stabilise the situation. That's something that we've talked about with our European and American friends. I spoke to the Iraqi Prime Minister just this morning, the Iraqi President last night, and I'll be reaching out to the Foreign Minister of Iran with that same message. You asked about General Soleimani. Let's be very clear. He was a regional menace, and we understand the position that the Americans found themselves in, and they have a right to exercise self-defense. They've explained the basis on which that's done, and we're sympathetic to the situation they found themselves in. But there is a risk with the heightening of tensions, and we now want to see the de-escalation and the stabilization of the situation. And a war, in fact, is in no one's interest. The only people that would gain would be Daesh and the terrorists that would exploit the vacuum. So we'll be working very hard throughout the diplomatic network with all of our partners, the US, the Europeans, and in the region, to get that message across loud and clear.
The Shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry, took a less forgiving view of the situation.
I didn't shed any tears for Soleimani. I fully understand his pattern of behaviour. He was essentially in charge of the defence forces for Iran. Their behaviour across the region has been one that has been destabilising. He has the blood of many people on his hands. His pattern of behaviour has been such that has been unacceptable and contrary to international law for a long time. However, to take him out at this stage, when there has been escalating tensions, seems to me to not be making the world safer. Actually, we are taking a major lurch towards war. And we're doing that because the president is reckless and hasn't thought through, I don't think, what it is that he's doing. But it seems to me quite clear that the Iranians are going to counterattack, and it means that our interests, our people, our forces are of course under threat. You know, there will be more attacks on the tankers. We have relatively lightly armed members of the armed forces in Iraq, for example. You know, they are clearly vulnerable. We have civilians there. We have embassies in the region. Yes, of course, everyone is now vulnerable. And he didn't even tell us before he agreed for this man to be killed in Baghdad. I mean, that's the other point, is that they breached Iraqi sovereignty in order to kill the head of the defence forces for Iran. And so how are the Iraqis supposed to respond to that? You know, there will be great pressure on the Iraqis to say to the Americans and to the British and to the other Western allies that have been trying to help them fight ISIS that they should leave. And so I think that it makes the whole area much more unstable and much more dangerous.
Do you think we could be heading towards a war?
Yes. And I think the point is this, is that what we should be saying quite clearly now is we will not be involved in this.
Ridge also asked Thornberry, who is running to be the next leader of the Labour Party, where things had gone wrong last December.
I think there are all kinds of criticisms in terms of the way in which the election was organised. I think that it was done very badly. I think that we weren't sufficiently clear about what our priorities were. I think that there's nobody, if anybody looks at the manifesto, they can't say, well, I don't like this or I don't like that. But there was too much in it. We didn't have...
People didn't trust it.
Well, it just wasn't convincing because there was too much in it. And in the end, you know, we can say until we're blue in the face that there is another way, and there is. But we won't get the opportunity to serve if people don't believe us and they don't believe in us. And if we're not competent and if we're not trustworthy, then they won't give us the chance to do it.
Andrew Marr spoke to the front runner in the race, the Shadow Brexit Secretary, Sir Keir Starmer. Starmer told Marr about how he felt Labour could have improved its message on Brexit.
I thought that we should have taken a stronger position one way or the other, and I argued for it. I lost that argument, but I accepted the result. But we didn't. My central.
But more Remain would have been even worse.
I think clarity about what your position is, and not being able to say, well, would you be leave or remain after a general election was a problem, and I made that argument, but I accepted
Sorry,
the decision.
Just picking up on that, do you think you would have won this election or done much better had you gone into the election as a clearly Remain party?
I think people wanted clarity and they wanted leadership. But I actually, what was coming up on the doorsteps and what the teams were telling me and my own experience was not so much people saying to me, I don't much like Labour's position, but they had bought the idea that if you voted Tory, you'd get Brexit done. And we didn't knock it down hard enough in the election. And I'd have liked the opportunity to knock it down hard because that was what was coming back. People were saying to us, ah, this will get Brexit done. We hadn't destroyed and wrestled that phrase to the ground.
Ma also spoke to Jess Phillips, who has thrown her hat into the ring. Ma questioned her about where she stood on rejoining the EU.
If you become Labour leader, we might have been out of the EU then by about 3 years. Is the Labour Party then a return to the EU party, or do you accept that argument is over?
Look, Boris Johnson has a majority of 80. The Labour Party losing the election has consequences that we have to deal with. So I have to face the fact that as somebody who... I have a Leave seat, but I campaigned for Remain because I thought it was the best thing for the people that I represent, and I thought it was the best thing for the country. And I'm not going to just change my mind on that. But what we have to do is wait and see.
So you're a rejoiner now?
No, we have to wait and see the situation where we are. People can sit and pretend that they know what it's going to be, but that is just a lie. We have to wait and see. But I will always think that we are better off, we are safer. All this conversation about Iran
That's really interesting.
Today,
so you, if you're Labour leader in a few weeks' time or a few months' time, the Labour Party policy could be that eventually you'd like to return to the EU.
You would have to look at what was going on at the time. If Boris Johnson, what our job is for the next 3 years is to hold Boris Johnson to account on all the promises. So if we are living in an absolute paradise of trade and we're totally safe in the world and we're not worrying about having to constantly look to America for our safety and security, then maybe we'll be wrong, maybe I'll be proven wrong. But the reality is if our country is safer, if it is more economically viable to be in the European Union, then I will fight for that, regardless of how difficult that argument is to make.
Wigan MP Lisa Nandy, yet another contender for Labour's top job, told Ridge where she felt some of Labour's problems lay.
I think there is definitely a disconnect between the hierarchy of the Labour Party and the country and people in towns like mine who were when Brexit happened, we immediately went straight to a discussion about free movement, single markets, customs unions, all of which are very, very important to people right across the country, including in Wigan. But what we hadn't understood was that take back control resonated like no other slogan in my lifetime. Why did it resonate? Because people lack the means to effect change in their own lives. And Labour has, in recent years, has become a very paternalistic party. We commission think tanks to write us reports in central London. We sit behind desks in Westminster or in Victoria Street, commissioning opinion polls and focus groups. And then we go out and we tell people that we're going to fix it.
Do you think actually people perhaps look down on some voters in your area then?
Well, I think that is that is a way of patronising people, because actually we've always been a movement that was built by and for working people, for working people to effect change in their own lives and to change the circumstances of their own lives.
And finally, Lord Barclay, the deputy chair of the government's review into HS2, has broken ranks to make clear how he feels about the project.
You were so disillusioned with the official report, if you like, commissioned by the government, that you've produced your own. What's in it?
My report suggests that the project is completely out of control financially. And it doesn't actually do what's in the tin, because it doesn't benefit the North and the Midlands in the way that upgrading existing lines could. And also they fiddled the figures to improve the benefit-cost ratio by allowing for 18 trains an hour to go on the line when nobody in the world runs more than 14. So the revenue's all shot to pieces, really.
I mean, fiddle the figures is quite a strong accusation that you're making here. Who fiddled the figures, firstly? And secondly, are you saying that Parliament's been misled?
I believe that Parliament's been misled because the costs were clearly known to the Department of Transport and I believe ministers 3 or 4 years ago. There's a lot of evidence for that. And the cost at that stage, they were saying, well, it's
probably they were over 100 billion. Now I think the figure, which I believe is about right, is 107 billion. It's an enormous figure, and Parliament should have had an opportunity to debate this.
But these are estimates, though, aren't they? I mean, people just have to go on effectively, you know, their best guess, don't they? I mean, the figures aren't always going to be right.
Well, everything's an estimate. But on the other hand, people are complaining, I think quite rightly, that Crossrail has gone up in maybe 25%. Cost increase now, that's at the end of construction. This project is probably two or three times over budget, even before the construction has started. Now, that's a completely different level of cost overrun, and it does need looking at again.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffeehouse Shots podcast on the iTunes store, and we also have a special offer. You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks in print and online for just £12, and you'll receive a free £20 gift card to spend at Amazon. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe to our daily Evening Blend email. It's a free roundup of all the political news each day, along with analysis and a diary on what to expect next. Just go to spectator.co.uk/Evening Blend. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.